Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, January 29th, 2018. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 73-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. And that issue should be hitting the mailboxes of Commentary subscribers today or tomorrow, one of the best we've ever done. And you can read it online, but only a few items from it until we ask you to subscribe. And you should do that. You should pay $29.95 so you can get it in your mailbox. We're very proud of it. We're now preparing the March issue. That's how it works. That's how we're a month ahead. So we're just trying to keep you on your toes. So guys, who watched the Grammys? Anybody watch the Grammys? I'm 56, so of course I really enjoyed the performances from Evita and West Side Story. That's my idea of a good Grammy show. You know, that and, you know, maybe some, Geritol and, soft food for my soft palate.
I started watching it, and then it became increasingly a sort of background element in my apartment as it went on.
My favorite part was when some neurasthenic 5'3" tall guy with glasses, who goes by the name of Logic, made a big speech to women about how you need to keep revealing your truth. You know, and he looked like he was the sort of person who, after the song was over, would go into the locker room and then the bigger boys would snap their towels at him. That was the weirdest moment, was, you know, Logic's mansplaining to women about how they should keep talking. Of course, the big moment at the Grammys that we need to talk about was the jokey film clip in which John Legend and Snoop Dogg and various other people read from Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury, and they kept reading, and then finally the book dropped at the end, and it was Hillary Clinton reading a passage from Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury, which occasioned a reporter named Ann Gearin writing about how that was so funny, and oddly, instantly, Nikki Haley, our ambassador to the UN, responded by saying that it ruined the Grammys for her. She hates all the politicization, and she used to like watching it, but now they're ruining it. Which actually seemed to be an interesting moment. It was sort of like an unguarded moment from a political official saying, I really don't like how this stuff happens. It seems to be an uncontroversial thing for a conservative to say that they can't stand how all award shows are just taken over by liberal pap. And then the response was various people in the mainstream media including Bill Ware of CNN and Dave Itzkoff of the New York Times and others making fun of Nikki Haley for daring to question the political view of the Grammys. So here again, we have one of these mini controversies that erupts solely and exclusively because a public official, and an admirable public official in my view, simply said something heartfelt about something that really annoyed her.
A little bit more than that, honestly, and it exposes the extent to which her critics were A, ill-informed, or B, utterly callous and ignorant of the extent to which the Me Too moment has included not just revulsion towards sexual harassment, but also the stereotypes that keep women in positions of inferiority in the working place. Nikki Haley was smeared over the weekend by the author of Fire and Fury, Michael Wolff. He appeared on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, where he implied very strongly that he is positive that Donald Trump is having an affair. And if you read the book, you'll find out where I think that's the case. And in Politico, shortly thereafter, it was published that people were going through this and found an anecdote in which Wolf described how Haley and Trump were spending quite a bit of private time on Air Force One. And Nikki Haley was asked about this. She was forced to respond to it. And it became, over the weekend, the notion that she was having liaisons with the President of the United States became something that she had to actually respond to. And it goes to the notion that a lot of women used to care about, particularly in the Me Too moment, which is that this idea that the powerful woman in the room only got ahead by sleeping her way to the top. And all of a sudden, that disappeared. Also, you know, Hillary Clinton had kind of her own little controversy over the weekend.
Right, but let's get to that second. So basically, in this case, what we have is Nikki Haley, governor of South Carolina, and now UN ambassador.
Not her first false sex scandal.
Right, and so during her first major run for office in South Carolina, the rumors were spread by both Democrats and Republicans that she had, you know, been having an affair with somebody in the state house, which was not true, was disproven, and she, you know, responded angrily, and same way she did on Sunday. So I think Noah's point, which is that apparently it's okay to make fun of Nikki Haley for objecting to the politicization of the Grammys, because it's okay that she be accused of getting ahead by virtue of the fact that she's an attractive woman. So meanwhile, you know, Kesha is singing about her torment, and Logic is mansplaining, and, you know, Janelle Monáe is standing there looking like a combination between a, you know, stormtrooper and an Oompa Loompa, talking about how we're not going to, you know, we're not going to fall for this again. And the other thing about the mainstream media's response to this is, we spent a month, I think, or maybe it's even less than a month, of people in the mainstream media pointing out all the many inaccuracies and falsehoods in Michael Wolff's book. And the fact that it just got a minute-long free commercial from the Grammys, you know, which is basically what happened, despite the fact that it has been proved to be an unreliable account, and in which you can't take a single anecdote at face value without making sure that, you know, Wolf didn't just make it up, because he is a liar and a cheat and a fraud. You know, that also goes by the wayside, just in favor of a joke about how, oh, these Trumpians, they're all so sensitive. They're too sensitive.
There's also, I think, there's a reminder here of the fact, a point I'm not the first to make, and I've certainly made on this podcast and elsewhere, that Trump is not only a driver of the vulgarity of the culture, but he's also a reflection of it. It's not as though before Trump came around, the U.S. and our certainly our media culture, our entertainment culture were these pristine places of dignity and honor. He's a reflection of it. The one-sidedness of it had already come to the forefront. The way that you can make fun of conservative women, you can portray Lady Thatcher as this in her worst and most, you know, difficult stages on screen, and kind of take a pleasure in watching, you know, Britain's great conservative prime minister in those stages of life. Or you can, you know, even as much as I don't like her, you can attack the Palin family over their choices about, they're keeping a baby with Down syndrome, and all this other stuff was long predated Trump. So, and honestly, I mean, it doesn't make me less allergic to Trump's own vulgarity, his own constant, his paranoid stream of unconsciousness tweets, his, you know, his insults to every figure, major and minor, on the national stage. But it makes me less willing to listen to liberals when they make these points, because they built this culture.
Abe, just want to say, I ask you this question.
All right.
So we're all keyed to the fact that Trump is a culture warrior, picking fights, right? So he picks fights with the NFL, he picks fights with Jay-Z, he picks fights with whoever. But he is not the only culture warrior. The entire liberal culture is engaged in a culture war against the values of the people who have now found it necessary to align with Trump. Right? I mean, isn't this part of that?
Yeah, this is, I mean, Trump's sort of cultural activism and his cultural combat strikes me as something very much imported from liberals, really. I mean, it's he does the kind of thing that conservatives didn't really do up until him. It's on the model of liberal activism. And the other thing that strikes me about this is that what will it take for Hillary Clinton to wear out her welcome among among the sort of progressive entertainment industry?
It's a good question.
I mean, because we've sat here, we've talked about how, you know, sort of Donna Brazile's revelations and the very fact that Hillary lost and gave the presidency to Donald Trump has sort of, you know, made her persona non grata among actual Democrats. But she still has some sort of salience in the culture on the left, and that's just it's keeps astounding me.
That's why Sareb put his finger exactly on what the problem was here, where it's just, you know, the hypocrisy that conservative women can be accused of X, Y, and Z, and nobody cares, and liberal women can't. Who, you know that it's a double standard. We're all familiar with it, but rarely has it been so crystallized as it was in the case of this weekend failing to spike that bit with Hillary Clinton. Because on Friday, it was revealed that Hillary Clinton was once again standing by her man in the form of her faith advisor in 2008, who was accused of improper conduct, sexually improper conduct, not assault, but harassment. It was recommended that she should remove him from the campaign. She declined to do that. She gave him some counseling and kept him where he was. The accuser, meanwhile, was reassigned. And then when this came out, she issued a set of very bizarre tweets, sort of lackadaisically addressing the issue and then sort of sidestepping it. And then she put out a Twitter video in which somebody told her to say that she should thank the activist bitches. And so she did. She thanked you, activist bitches, using that word. And I feel like people just kind of ignored it because we're not really sure how to process what that meant. It was stupid and glib and offensive. And the extent to which anybody wanted to deal with it, it was only the right. So we had the Grammys perfectly illustrated the extent to which the left was willing to forgive Hillary Clinton her indiscretions, was willing to tolerate misinformation as long as it smeared Trump, and was willing to sanction, essentially, the smear campaign against a powerful woman who doesn't deserve it, who happens to get this kind of treatment only because she's a Republican working for a Republican administration. I don't know if you can define hypocrisy better than what we witnessed on the stage at the Grammys.
Well, I mean, this is part of the problem with, I have to say, you know, how our culture now centers so much on entertainment that even the Grammys, which is the award ceremony honoring the most notably brainless form of entertainment that we have. I mean, as say, you know, the Oscars involve screenwriting and, you know, sort of some efforts to grapple with things. And, you know, the Tonys involve plays and the Pulitzers involve books. And the Grammys involve 3-minute lousy songs, you know, that occasionally get catchy or interesting. But, what? You know, you only have to watch the Grammys and see the parade of bizarrery. I mean, it is a freak show. It's designed to be a freak show, sort of clothing freak show, a personal behavior freak show. And listen to the illiteracy and almost, you know, like these people can't even speak English. One. Can't even speak English it's their native tongue, and they can barely speak English. And that they too now think that they're in a position to give America lectures about proper behavior and comportment. I mean, if the Me Too moment actually ever stretched to pop music, there is not an act in the history of the planet that wouldn't be now, you know, fired and silenced by, you know, a publicly traded company.
And this wasn't the only kind of pop culture, media / entertainment moment of glory for the resistance this weekend. I don't know if you guys saw, but Jose Andreas, this celebrity chef in Washington, he makes great tapas, accused the owner of a different restaurant of barring him from a kind of black tie event at which Ivanka Trump was featured, and he accused the chef, the owner of Cafe Milano, of doing that. Andreas did. supposedly at the behest of Ivanka Trump, because Andreas has been a critic of the Trump administration.
Well, not a critic of the Trump administration. He was in a lawsuit.
That's right.
Because he was supposed to open a restaurant in the Trump Hotel in Washington and pulled out because he said he couldn't countenance the Judge Curiel, the Trump's talk about Judge Curiel. And so the Trump administration's Trump organization sued Andreas, so they were in a lawsuit together, which is what made this story initially seem plausible, and that like Ivanka Trump wouldn't want to be in a room with
a guy who's
Jose Andreas, whom she has been in litigation with. However,
thousands of people retweeted tweets by Anthony Bourdain, but just every kind of liberal media figure you can imagine. And then it turns out that this was an event where even if you have a paper invitation, you're not guaranteed a seat because it is so exclusive. There's so many CEOs and other hotshots that they have 150 seats and they keep it at that. So Jose Andreas just didn't have a paper invitation, and he just expected to roll in like any other after party in Washington. And this is one party where it has a long-standing reputation for the one where you can't just roll in. You really, even if you have a paper one, you're not quite securely in. So that was really it. Ivanka had done nothing. Jose Andreas pulled this out of nowhere, and it's just these types of stories that you combine that with Nikki Haley, the insults at Nikki Haley. You combine that with the Grammys, right, and you think the resistance is really doing Trump's work for him.
Well, yeah, and I just want to return to John's point about the hypocrisy in the music industry. One of the stories coming out of the Grammys by like the sort of woke media or those woke-ish media is how hip-hop has gotten snubbed, because supposedly this was a year of all these supposedly groundbreaking hip-hop albums and they didn't win and Jay-Z didn't win. And meanwhile, it's this Me Too Time's Up moment. Hip-hop is nothing. What has been the bread and butter of hip-hop for decades has been the objectification.
Talking down the non-activist bees, I believe, would be correct. Yeah. So, right? It's like if Hillary Clinton is praising the activist bees,
yes,
I think
exactly
the general...
Right. No, it's like the Access Hollywood tape, for records for 30 years that has been, you know, sort of a huge chunk of what hip-hop is. So wouldn't this be the time to say, you know, like, you know, maybe hip-hop should take a backseat? Was Russell Simmons at the Grammys? I doubt it.
I'm actually raising that in a piece I'm writing on this. He's been accused of assault or harassment over the course of a quarter century by six women, hosted a variety of Grammy parties, was honored by the Grammys Museum. Nobody's going to deal with that, of course, because it's easier just to wear a white rose. But it's also not the correct response, in my view, to censor art or blame art for this behaviors of people who are otherwise almost criminal. It's not as though we can... That's just another easy way for us to dissociate with this moment and the cause and effect of it. It's not because rap music or, you know, certain types of rap music, and we're not talking about Tribe Called Quest here, we're just talking about a particular type of rap music, and that's not responsible for a culture.
Oh, yeah, I'm not talking about censoring or blaming. I'm just talking about assessing it honestly. Yeah.
Or even to say, you know, you guys need to take a back seat in this moment. It's just, you know, everybody needs to come to the table.
No, it's have to or not have to. It's all a question of how these industries wish to present themselves in the midst of controversy. Hollywood has to present itself in a different fashion because it is the originating source of this entire moment, right? I mean, the Harvey Weinstein story is the story that kicked this off. He's a major producer. Producer who has won more Oscars than any other individual producer over the last 25 years. And so... the entertainment industry, the Hollywood, the movie industry has to sort of deal with it in that way. What I'm saying is that the music industry in the United States for the last 50 years has been a wellspring of foul, disgusting personal behavior, particularly sexually, not only in the music that it produces and the kinds of things that it promotes, but in backstage behavior that is legendary, and there is not a band that you can name of any significance of which this is not the case.
The Osmonds.
The Osmonds, okay. Are they a band of significance? I would say they are not a band of significance. And not just a band, but performers. I mean, it's the lingua franca of of pop music. It's why people get into it. It's why people do it. It's one of the things it's one of the rewards you're supposed to be able to get when you go on the road. And if you think that people behave badly in Hollywood, I mean, you know, from the Brill Building, where the songs of Broadway and rock and roll were first introduced to now, somehow it hasn't quite.
Except, Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Right. Well, Baby, It's Cold Outside, which is one of my favorite songs, has a lot to answer for, because not only has it become this question of whether or not this song is a sort of a power seduction Me Too song, but it also created the Muslim Brotherhood.
That's right.
Are you guys aware of the role that Baby It's Cold Outside?
Syed Qutb heard it?
Yes, Syed Qutb heard it when he was in, was it Greenwood, Colorado?
Greeley,
Colorado in 1949, and decided that this song, which is, you know, a guy and a woman sitting on a couch, and, you know, he's trying to get her not to leave, and she's kind of not sure whether she should stay or go. This was the mark of the irredeemably corrupt Western culture, and he went back to Egypt to start the Muslim Brotherhood.
He didn't start it. He joined
arguably, excuse me, right, it started, but he kind of revolutionized it. So basically, 9/11 is the fault of Frank Lesser,
really,
who wrote Baby,
hate
It's
us
Cold
for
Outside.
Our freedoms.
They hate us for our Me Too. I mean, so yes, Baby, It's Cold Outside. But I really do. It is amazing how there has not been a reckoning for the. I mean, in some ways, there's always been. It's the one thing that you can always reliably count on, or stories about how some rock star, pop star did the nasty with some, you know, I mean, dating back to Chuck Berry in the late 50s. Every couple of years, there's a story. Somebody goes to jail, you know, or you know, dies of an overdose with a girl in his bed, or a girl dies of an overdose with him in the bed, or something like that. It's not like it's not a sort of ongoing subplot of the pop music industry. But again, compared to, Hollywood's like the Osmonds compared to the music industry, I would say, very possibly. So we need to take a little pause so that I can talk to you guys about the very interesting website, tripping.com. Now, did you know that the average family visits 5 totally different websites before booking a vacation rental? Did you know that? Well, you can spend less time planning your next trip and more time relaxing with tripping.com, the world's number one site for vacation rentals. Tripping.com is trusted by millions of travelers and featured by the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Forbes, and more. Whether you're looking for a cabin or a beachfront home to get away to this winter, or already looking ahead to vacations this spring, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. Vacation rentals offer flexibility, perks, and amenities that hotels don't, like multiple bedrooms, backyards, hot tubs, free Wi-Fi, even fully stocked kitchens so you can plan and cook your own meals. Great for families and large groups. With Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. And don't worry, if you're getting the best deal, you'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. So don't forget, if you want to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip, head to Tripping.com/commentary today. That's TRIPPING.com/commentary, tripping.com/commentary. Okay, so of course, there's endless news in the Trump, Russia, House, Memo, Devin Nunes, Rod Rosenstein. Just throw names in there. Just throw more names in. Thing. So the big story, of course... two big stories. One is that Trump ordered in June, Trump ordered his lawyer, Don McGahn, to fire Robert Mueller, and McGahn wouldn't do it. That was a story in the New York Times. And then today in the New York Times, we have another story about how the now legendary unseen Devin Nunes memo stars Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who is in supervisory charge of Mueller and the Russia investigation since Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself, and that Rosenstein, his behavior suggests to Trump from what Trump has heard, that he would want the memo released because it would give Trump grounds to fire Rosenstein and hire somebody else who would be more amenable to firing Robert Mueller than Rosenstein, who appointed Mueller, is. Because statutorily, Trump can't fire Mueller. Only Rosenstein can fire Mueller. Now, I think as a matter of constitutional law, that's ridiculous because Rosenstein works for Trump. If Rosenstein has the power to fire Mueller, Trump, by definition, has the power to fire Mueller because Rosenstein is his subordinate. Having said that, whatever. So that is the...
Well, McGahn's office isn't as certain as you are because they investigated this avenue, according to the New York Times.
Yes.
They were investigated all avenues, which means... Again,
they investigated this avenue by reading a 2013 report by the Congressional Research Service, which is the only thing.
The only way that we know about this sort of thing.
Okay, I'm just saying that as a matter of constitutional law, the executive branch, the powers of the executive branch, and here in the president, therefore anything that is done by the executive branch is done effectively by the president, therefore the president can fire anybody in the executive
branch.
It's
debatable. What's not debatable is that
it's debatable, but I'm right.
Joe Manchin
you can debate it all you like, but what I just said is entirely logical, and the position that Trump's subordinate has powers that Trump doesn't possess is insane.
Irrelevant to what we're talking
about. I refuse to accept that.
So what it does prove is that Joe Manchin was being... garbage person when he said that this was just New York talk and it was fleeting.
You just called Joe Manchin a garbage person. You can't call Joe Manchin a garbage person.
It was garbage nonsense.
The man shot through the cap and trade bill with a gun.
That was notable and laudable. So it wasn't just New York talk. It wasn't just a fleeting impulse. They were very methodical about this. It didn't just come up and then disappear the next day. Donald Trump brought it up again in an interview with the New York Times nearly a month later, in which he pretty much drew a red line at the investigation of his finances, said this is supposed to be a route Russia. Once it gets into my finances, I'm going to start thinking about things I can do. And the context of what he was talking about was dismissing the Mueller probe. So it's not as though this was just something that came out of the blue, as Donald Trump's defenders are saying today, that, oh, he was going to do something, he didn't do it. He has the power to do it, but he didn't. It's not news, and why are we even talking about this non-news anyway?
Okay. I do think that it is news in this sense, which is that apparently he ordered McGahn to fire Mueller. McGahn refused to fire Mueller, and Trump dropped it. Now, why is that news? It's news in two ways, one of which is that it shows that, contra David Frum and some other people, the institutions are holding in this sense, which is that if Trump went to McGahn and said, I want you to go fire Mueller, and McGahn said, whoa, buddy, I'm not destroying my life for you. You want me to do this? I quit. And what's more, if I quit, I can go and say whatever I want to about what the hell you're doing. And if you do this, you're dead. Because I'm not saying that this is what he said to Trump, because if you want to prove, if Mueller wants to prove obstruction of justice, or the House wants to investigate and write, you know, get you into big trouble, this will get you into big trouble, right? So, and then Trump didn't fire Mueller. So, one, we have the institutions holding. That is that Trump does not have such control, unlike in other systems, he does not have such control that his lackeys are apparently willing to do anything for him because they have their own personal interests. And they, as officials of the federal government, have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Ultimately, a couple of people have said over the weekend, or Newt Gingrich said over the weekend, I mean, if they're not loyal to Trump, if the deep state or whatever isn't loyal to Trump, what the hell are they loyal to, said Gingrich. Well, the fact is that every federal official is supposed to be loyal to the Constitution of the United States, to which they swear an oath when they join the government. Not to the president, not to an individual, not to a person. We are not a country governed by people. We are a country governed by laws that are overseen by a constitutional structure. So the institutions are holding. And then the other thing is, of course, that it proves that Trump may have wanted to obstruct justice, but as yet cannot be proved to have done so. Now, that he wanted to obstruct justice, I think, was pretty clear. He himself said, as you, Noah, said, that in July, he said, touch this, and I'm going after you, which is a form of, threat, you know? He's saying, if you go in this area, I'm calling, you know, I'm calling foul and firing you. So I will obstruct justice if you go there. And so I think that's a pretty serious thing to look at. But to obstruct justice, you actually have to pull the trigger. You have to pull the lever. You have to obstruct the thing to obstruct it. And so while this is suggestive, it is not determinative. And people seem to think that some people on, you know, who are in the Trump must be impeached for any and all reasons seem to think that this is the smoking gun that takes him down. But I just don't understand how you can look at something, the story of which is that he didn't do the thing that would have meant that he was obstructing justice.
Look, I think it's even more consequential that he actually said at the time that if my personal finances come up, if my family's finances come up, then I'm going to have to do something. Because that's a sort of strange, almost, and it's not an admission of anything, but what's he alluding to? Why would that be a red line that you wouldn't want to cross? That you wouldn't want to cross?
Two things. For the same reason he hasn't released his tax returns. There must be something there.
Well, right. It's a way of saying there's something there.
Right, that's what I mean.
Go there. Right. Don't go into that closet.
That's why I say it's more meaningful.
But multiple things here. One, in the interests of being, you know, 100% clear about everything that's on the table. Oops, sorry. When it comes to obstruction of justice, some have said that it's the extent to which Donald Trump was willing to mislead regarding the statement that was drafted on Air Force One absolving Donald Trump Jr. of taking this meeting, or rather of speaking with his father about this meeting. The president's staffers said that the president
had nothing to do with it. Okay, the meeting is a June 6th Trump Tower meeting with Russian lawyer Ms.
Veselnitskaya.
And when the story was coming out of the New York Times that it happened, Trump and everybody was on Air Force One, and a memo was drafted. And Trump apparently took the lead in drafting the memo, and it was basically just made up stuff.
Yeah, but that was a lie. So that's a big deal. But to the exculpatory part of this thing, you know, Donald Trump's finances were always going to be investigated as part of a Russian investigation. You can't do an investigation about Donald Trump's ties to Russia without investigating the extent to which the Trump organization, Trump himself, has ties to Russia, financial or otherwise. So that immediately came out, and that has been in the case for the last 6 months. And the president hasn't moved against this probe. So those who were really, you know, a fear that was going to be the trigger, it hasn't been the trigger.
And Mueller has the power to investigate his finances. According to the order written by Rod Rosenstein, whom Trump now apparently hates, establishing the special counsel investigation, quote, the special counsel, quote, is authorized to conduct the investigation. And that includes, quote, any links and or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump, unquote, as well as, quote, any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation. Any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation, meaning if there's some indication that Trump met with so-and-so and so-and-so is a friend of Putin's and that Trump had a meeting with him in 2014 and something happened at that meeting. That meeting in 2014, a year before he started running for office, fits under the writ, the originating writ of the investigation. So he is right to worry that investigations can go rogue and run amok and be terrible things, in which case he shouldn't have fired James Comey and forced the automatic. He shouldn't have fired James Comey, said he had tapes of James Comey, that proved that James Comey was lying and thus forced the creation of an independent counsel. All of this is a self-inflicted wound. All of it is a self-inflicted wound. In an effort to protect himself in some way with Comey, he opened himself up to something much worse. Why? Because he didn't know how government worked, because whatever other reason, and he may think that he's totally innocent, or he may think that there's stuff that he doesn't want people to see in his tax. It doesn't matter. Something happened in the first couple of weeks after he won the presidency in November, which is that he was briefed, and there was all this talk about how was he going to unwind his business? How is he going to divest himself of his business? It's a real estate business. It's really hard. There are 10,000 different limited partnerships and all this, and it was going to be so difficult. What was he going to do? And then basically somebody said to him, you know, that there is a body of constitutional law that says that you stand slightly outside the law as president of the United States. Like the executive branch's powers originate from you, so you can't get arrested because it would effectively be your arresting yourself, and you can't be investigated really because you can't investigate yourself. You know who you are. This is a sort of a weird issue of constitutional law and how the executive power inheres in a person. And so he thought that he had gotten a get out of jail free card. And he thought he could do whatever he wanted, I think. He sort of said that. Remember, he gave that press conference in November of 2016, which he said, I can basically do what I want. And then it turned out that you can't really do what you want. And he got very frustrated because it sounded like a great deal. This is fantastic. I can do whatever I want. And then he takes James Comey aside and has a New York Talk conversation with him, like, Go easy on Flynn. He's a good guy, right? You'll go easy on him, right? I need your loyalty. Go easy on him. With the notion that, you know, James Comey also is somebody who might have some understanding of New York Talk, having been a special prosecutor, having been the U.S. attorney in Brooklyn. And so what did he do? He goes back and starts taking notes on everything that the president said to him to protect himself and maybe to nail the president.
And it's a self-inflicted wound in another sense as well, namely, I mean, those of us in 2015, 2016 who were on the right and we were fuming over the fact that Trump would say things like, Russia, if you have our emails, release them, or suggesting all of his kind of Putin bromance stuff was obscene in an American. It laid the seed, or it planted the seed, for this idea that there was some deep connection between the two campaigns. Now, as this is going on, and I will not say definitively because who knows what Mueller is going to dig up, but so far, that's actually been pretty thin. And as even Noah has said and written, and so far as you look at the administration's policies, this does not look like an administration that's beholden to Moscow. But nevertheless, Trump had played a part in planting the seeds that he was some sort of Kremlin crony with his constant, obscene, un-American, unpatriotic campaign rhetoric about empowering or inviting Putin to interfere in our election in an open way. Maybe there was nothing to it. But in addition to the Comey firing, he damaged himself early on, even during the primaries, even before we got to the general election.
Right. So he invited both the collusion suspicions and the obstruction suspicions.
Exactly.
Right.
Both on himself. Yeah.
Right. So if you look at this and say that Trump himself never really thought he was going to win the election, what you have here is Trump laying a predicate for after the election, which has two faces, right? One of which is he was really nice to Putin. Maybe that'll help him make deals with Putin after the election when he loses. He can build Trump Tower in Moscow. He can make new deals. He can get new investments, all of that. That's one. And the other is that he was laying the predicate for being an eternal thorn in the side both of President Hillary Clinton and of the Republican Party, in which case he would say, you didn't listen to me. She's a crook. You didn't listen to me. This is what happened. You didn't listen to me. Look at Comey. He would use his Twitter feed to create this, be this constant kind of lord of misrule, you know, sort of like the Loki of American politics. He would just stand there and make trouble for anybody he wanted to make trouble for. And that's what he was establishing the predicate for in his behavior and why he was so uniquely unprepared to take the presidency and manage it in a rational fashion. Like, don't get yourself into trouble. Rule one of all presidencies is don't get yourself into trouble, because there are too many people with too much of an interest in tying you up, bollocksing you up, confusing you, you know, making you sort of jump through hoops and not pursue your own agenda. And all he did for the first 8 months was get himself into trouble. I mean, that's all he did, basically. So people now on the right may think that, boy, this is just everything is really going swimmingly, and that's really nice for them, and they can really look at the things that they like and, you know, the excitement over the tax bill and great stuff with Israel and other stuff like that. But, you know, if it turns out that November is as bad for Republicans as it's now looking, and we just got yet another bulletin over the wires that, I don't know, it was a 30-year congressman, Rodney Frelinghuysen from New Jersey, has decided he's not running for re-election.
He was budget committee chair, right?
Budget committee chair, very important, moderate Republican.
From New Jersey.
From New Jersey. So basically, that's another, right, so that's another, that's a seat totally gone. No Republican is going to, probably.
I don't know what that landscape is.
Nah, it's,
I don't
bad. It's bad. It's bad.
Partisan makeup.
No, I think it's a, it was a Clinton plus two seat or something like that, Clinton plus five. Anyway, so, you know, every piece of data is bad. I don't care what you say. Like, there seems to be this kind of weird optimism that seems to have overtaken Republicans now that they're feeling more cheerful about the way the country is going. But I don't
think... Any minute that everybody's going to notice that the economy is really good.
Yeah.
Any second.
Yeah, they might. And, you know, the truth is that if the economy grows at 8% in the second and third quarters, it'll really help Republicans not lose. But, I, you know, if it grows at the last quarter of 2016 was 2.6%, and, you know, that was way worse than a lot of people thought it was going to be.
We kind of had this conversation in the back room before we got on the air, and I guess we can bring it to the air now. To the extent that Republicans have convinced themselves of things that they used to dismiss, that the president is essentially the CEO of the United States, that he's more, he's not just, he's basically not really a constitutional officer, he's not an arbiter of culture, he's not an icon to which Americans should reflect and aspire to emulate, he's just essentially the chairman of the board, and he can be dismissed at the behest of the board itself, then you're pretty much okay with how things are going, because it's, the president has a fiduciary responsibility to his investors, and that's it. As long as he meets that, he's good. And we're still a little stung, I think, from the 2016 election, is that the potency of the president's base of support was totally underestimated for 2 years. It demonstrated its power in November of 2016, and everybody's been deferential to it ever since. I'm pretty sure that either diminishes or disappears in the event that there's a very strong Democratic wave in 2018, that 35% that is in the president's camp will look a lot more like 35% and not a silent majority lurking in the shadows, at which point all these contrivances that Republicans have convinced themselves of in order to maintain their support for Donald Trump without any caveats or any sort of, you know, very gentle nudges will look very foolish, will look sort of like whistling past the graveyard. And I can't imagine why it wouldn't. It probably should.
Unless there is a sort of other 10 or 15% of people who don't think of themselves as part of the 35% who, when called by pollsters or whoever, will say that they don't approve of him or they find various things distasteful about him. But they've come to see, like, look, he's appointing lots of conservative, you know, judges across the federal system. They might be those kind of suburban educated Republicans who like the tax cuts, who look at their investments, and they think, you know, and stick with him if the economy.
But they can stick with him. The question that faces Republicans in November is that people have to vote for people who are not named Trump. That could help them because they're not named Trump, and it could hurt them because they're not named Trump. In other words, the people who are willing to give credit for good stuff in the country may not give credit to their Republican congressman, who, after all, didn't appoint any judges and, you know, may have voted for the tax bill, but just voted for the tax bill. Now, it could go the other way. The mood in the country could be so wonderful that independents who say they don't like Trump and the Republicans will feel a lot better about them and therefore limit the damage. But you know, talking about this over and over again, I think mostly the thing that frustrates me is that there's the ability to view what is going on dispassionately, and then there's the question of whether or not your analysis should be colored by your wants. So if your want is a tax cut, a lot of deregulation, and judges, and Trump is fulfilling those, then your wants should then lead to your wants being fulfilled do not necessarily lead to analysis that says that everybody in the country who is showing ambivalence to hatred of Trump feels the way you do. and thinks the way you do and is going to soften their hearts toward Trump the way that your heart is either was already softened or will be softened. And I have many of the same feelings about these developments. I am tend not to credit Trump for them because I don't think that they are his direct. I mean, I think they're happening. They would have happened under any Republican, and that he, with the exception of stuff on Jerusalem, for which he is clearly, in some sense, the emotional driving force, and I give him great credit for that. I don't think he would get all that much, credit for this because, he could just as easily not have appointed Naomi Rao and to do deregulation, and that Leonard Leo is helping him choose judges is totally an artifact of a political moment during the campaign when he needed to wave to the Christian right. So he deserves some credit, but I just think that the notion that tens of millions of people are going to vote Republican instead of Democratic next November because of that is fanciful in the extreme.
There's what we're getting at and what we've gotten at before is that there's two sort of parallel phenomena. There's what the administration is doing, and then there's how Trump conducts himself. And on the latter, as John said, he sort of keeps getting into trouble. He just causes himself trouble over and over again. The question is, to my mind, do all these missteps, do they accumulate and make the case against him worse, or do we just sort of acclimate to them and we sort of care less about them as they go on? Or is there no difference? Or is it just they sort of don't have an effect either way?
Well, we don't know, and that's what elections
right.
will tend
I
to tell you.
I think we do know that the notion that the appointment of conservative justices is going to somehow penetrate the electorate has not. There's no evidence to support that. I mean, one of his very initial acts was the appointment of a very conservative, good Supreme Court justice. There have been just a deluge of conservative appointments and confirmations out of the Senate of some very good judges that are going to have an impact on the judiciary for decades to come. No one's noticed. Republicans are losing election after election because of the suburbs, because the suburbs are falling apart for them.
Right. In the end, all this is speculative.
The economy, right? I'm going to withhold judgment on because we don't know how people are going to react to the economy if it keeps going this direction.
Well, we have
tax cuts have a big impact on the perception of what the economy is and who's responsible for it.
I mean, we have evidence from American history and the way elections have gone that tax cuts need at least a year to sort of bubble through the system. For people to feel the impact of them, particularly when they have a better tax return in, say, 2019 than they did in 2018. Some of it is that, they're about to see more money in their paycheck, but, it could be that the timing of that is poor, if you think about it, which is that they'll start seeing money in their paycheck in January or early February when the tables are changed. And then there's another 9 months till the election or 10 months to the election, and they will have totally subsumed the fact that they got this pay raise as a result of this change in the income tax tables and will no longer feel it as a stark positive unless suddenly jobs are open to them that weren't open to them before. Job mobility is possible. Their housing values go up so that they can sell the house that they've been trapped in for 15 years, not at a loss, but, at a profit, that kind of thing. That will make a huge difference. But I think it takes longer than the period of time between now and the 2018 election.
But it's not just tax cuts either. I mean, there are other positive things going on economically. I mean, there's the consumer confidence and there's the stock market. I mean, they can all contribute to a general sense.
They can, but that's what I'm saying. I just think that the big personal effects, according to American history, the big personal effects take about a year for people to feel if they are really substantial.
And the president has to not loom over them as though, he's this colossus of a figure who overtakes the news cycle. Looking forward to an interview. Right. There's probably going to be a deposition unless the president's attorneys can manage to make the president walk back his determination to talk with the special counsel's office, which means they're getting close. They're getting close to a report. I mean, that means you don't talk to the president unless you're done with everything. You've got everything on the table. You're ready to confront the president on this sort of thing.
I don't know. Mark Warner, the senator from Virginia, said this morning in an interview with Politico that they got a bunch of documents at the end of the year that presumably Mueller is going to get also, that have new leads and new stuff about Russia that will lead them to spend months more in their investigation. And Warner has not been the flamethrower for the Democrats in this investigation, so who knows. The real question, I guess, which we haven't dealt with, and even though we're sort of running out of time, is the behavior of the Democrats, will the behavior of the Democrats impede their ability to ride this wave? Will they screw up their own wave because they can't keep their own powder dry the way Trump can't keep his powder dry? Now, I'm not sure what that is. Culturally, I don't quite see what it is that they would do or what it is they could be blamed for. The question is whether Trump picks fights that cause them to start advocating for things that are stupid. If somehow Black Lives Matter had arisen now instead of in 2014 or something like that, and you really had a lineup where you had, you know, Trump with the cops and Democrats with the protesters, the way you did, oddly, in 2014, 2015, when you had people protesting effectively the Obama administration, that could be bad. But I don't know do you see anything in the current context, including like the Grammy culture wars and stuff like that, that will impede the Democratic ability? Because remember, they do need to win in districts that are less favorable to them than the ones that
they haven't
had
the primaries yet. The primaries are coming up, right? And we anticipate some activist energy on the Democratic left that's forcing the party to the left. But how that'll manifest, I don't know. Right now, the party's narratives, as I wrote on Friday, are really incomprehensibly stupid. Is that $1,000 doesn't go anywhere, and it's crumbs, and you guys shouldn't be thankful for any of this stuff. And also, the notion that we should provide citizenship to 1.8 million Dreamers and their families is basically racism because it cuts down on other immigration. I mean, it just literally doesn't make any sense unless you're an activist Democrat.
Right. But I think if you're anywhere on the left, you think the sky is falling now, and you are coming out to vote against the Republicans no matter what.
Well, you're
not reading the fine print.
But okay, so that's really the question.
You could have a Democratic Todd Akin who wins a race or two. It makes a winnable race losable.
Okay, well, there's that. But then, mostly we're looking at the House. I mean, obviously, if there's a real, real wave, Democrats can win the Senate. But it's unlikely for Democrats to win the Senate. It's unlikely that they would lose the Senate because of a Todd Akin. Like, if there's a wave, they'll win. Their Todd Akin will win. But I'm thinking more along the lines of whether they, if they spend a year saying that the economy is bad when the economy is better than it was under Obama, that will be stupid because they will be pushing a line that will be, and they did this in 83 and 84, like Mondale lost 49 states to Reagan in part because he stood around saying the economy is terrible when it was growing at 8%. Like, that was stupid, but they didn't know what else to say. they had nothing else to say because they had bet the farm on the notion that the economy wasn't going
to
recover.
Well, I mean, I think they need to keep the argument about a cultural one. You know, as Noah was saying before we got in here, there's a sort of cultural question now. This is the midterms are going to be a sort of decide a cultural question. If the Democrats go full hog against sort of, policies and economic issues, they're gonna trip themselves up in ways that they don't need to. But if they just make it a matter of sort of general disgust, I think they're actually better.
But even the culture one is a double-edged sword in the sense, it really depends on how Democrats play the culture and whether to some extent they're willing to say that they've learned some of the lessons of 2016, that aggressive identity politics alienates a kind of large swaths of the country. That the attitudes that prevail among the kind of far left Black Lives Matter fringe is not how most people perceive police and perceive community policing. That the furthest reaches of fringes of the pro-choice or the pro-abortion movement is not, again, does not play well in parts of the country where a Democrat could plausibly win. So if they can be a kind of responsible cultural opposition that says, look, that Trump has degraded the tone of this country, and here's a sort of what a responsible alternative and leadership could look like, they may have a chance on the culture front. And I remember David Frum early on wrote an essay soon after Trump either was inaugurated or was it just right after the election. I can't remember what he said. You know, if you want to form an anti-Trump opposition, make sure you dress up in suits and honor the flag and be patriotic and don't do what precisely what Democrats are doing, which is say like borders mean nothing, immigration is just a piece of citizenship is just a piece of paper, citizenship for all, down with the police, stuff like that. Like that, I don't think reflects an appreciation for what happened in culturally in 2016.
I think we'd appreciate that. I don't know that they need to do that to triumph this time around.
Yeah, that's really the question. I think more in the economic realm, are there districts where it's going to be necessary, the test case will be whether there are districts where it'll be necessary for, say, a Democrat not to say that fracking is evil in order to win, and will that be acceptable if that guy Steyer is the single biggest donor to the party and is religiously opposed to all forms of new energy exploration, for example? Like, but in individual districts, which could make the difference between winning 30 seats and just taking the House and 60 seats and like blowing out the Republicans, if that's even possible. Democrats are going to have to take somewhat heterodox positions again, not necessarily against their party, but they might have to be pro-life or support 20-week or support, banning abortions after 20 weeks. Stuff. Will they be allowed to?
Does that really matter in a wave, though? I mean, in a wave, everything sort of goes in the same direction, and the candidates just have to be warm bodies.
But it's still
not entirely. It matters in the sense that, yeah, you can be a wave and a warm. You get a wave is a national effect, but it can be, but you can put up breakers in individual districts that save them. I mean, that's part of what happens.
You know, my feeling on this is that Democrats can go radical. They don't have to change at all. They'll benefit from a shift in the pendulum, and Republicans will go more radical in response, and a radicalism will continue until we all fall into the ocean.
We should stop. We can't help ourselves talking about 2018 because it's so much fun. But, we've explored this so much, and God knows, nothing's going to – the balance of forces are going to remain what they're going to remain. The other thing I should say before we kick off is I am cognizant of the fact that a bunch of polls came out that had the generic ballot, that is, would you vote for a Democrat or a Republican, shifting into single digits when they were all in double digits in December. A lot of that is because Trump was out of the news, not because he was in the news. And so he will not ever be out of the news again. In my view, and so I don't know that those numbers are going to hold back in the single digits. If the notion is that Republicans will benefit from Trump being invisible, they need to have a different hope, because he doesn't want to be invisible and the opposition doesn't want to be invisible. So, for A. Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Sora Mamari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.